Finance and Leadership, FTI's Financial Services Podcast. FTI is a global advisory firm. We help organizations manage change, mitigate risk, and resolve disputes. I'm your host, Tilcia Toledo. I have over 25 years of experience in the financial services industry. This show is about the people I've met along the way and leading during uncertain times. You will hear from finance executives, law firm partners, dedicated government professionals, and many others.
Hello, everyone. I ended 2023 with an episode on artificial intelligence. As promised, I'm starting 2024 with another AI episode. I had the pleasure to speak with a leader in digital transformation and privacy strategies. Today's guest is Dominic Shelton-Lepzig. Dominic is a Mayer Brown privacy and cybersecurity partner. Leading global data innovation, she counsels CEOs and board members on smart digital governance. We cover a number of topics, including her fourth book entitled Trust. Please enjoy. Dominic, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tilcia. So great to see you.
So I want to start with just going back in history a little bit, because you have such a great career, and I always enjoy hearing about how people got to where they are right now. So can you tell us a little bit about what caused you to get into legal practice?
Wow. So this started very early for me. Just, you know, ever since I was maybe 8 years old, I had a desire to be an attorney. I think it was greatly influenced by the fact that my dad was in law school when I was growing up, starting, I don't know, maybe about age six. So I remember him talking about cases a lot. And then my mother, although she's a professor of French at Claremont McKenna College in California, had studied law herself when she was younger back in Haiti. Her father was an attorney. And then my uncles on my mom's side, and I just, law was kind of around, and I felt very comfortable that this is where I wanted to point my career.
So it almost would have been unusual if you had not been in law practice, given how much exposure you had to it early on.
Yeah. And my sister ended up going to law school too. She doesn't practice, but she and I both went to Georgetown at different times. I graduated in 91. She graduated in 95. So it just, there's a lot of law.
Excellent. But then within law, there's so many different areas. So what caused you to really get into digital transformation and privacy?
You know, when you look at a career from one stance, looking back, it seems like everything was falling into place and it was all planned. But as a matter of fact, some threads came together that were very disparate, but now all makes sense. So I was in international relations and French civilization, a double major at Brown University. And I went to Georgetown Law because I was really interested in international affairs and international at that time. I thought international law. So I'll never forget my second year of law school. I took a privacy in American law seminar with Professor Anita Allen, who is, I believe, now vice provost at UPenn Law, a trailblazer on feminist theory as it relates to privacy and so many other areas, but she's written numerous books. But that was my favorite class, gotta say. And, you know, there was no internet at that time. We were just grappling with the issues. I wrote my paper on privacy and American law, like basically privacy for public figures. And I was basing it on the sexual orientation outing of Representative Barney Frank. And I argued then that public individuals had a right to privacy in their private lives. Of course, now that's so overtaken by events. I feel like our public, you know, officials basically have zero privacy, but that's what I was arguing back then. So there was my favorite class. I learned by my second year in law school that international law had kind of two components at that time in the early 90s. This was 1990. Either public international law, so to go argue at The Hague and so forth on, you know, major issues, human rights issues, Rwanda, et cetera, so forth, or international tax or business in a law firm. So I had spent a summer in Los Angeles working at a major law firm, one of the, you know, largest law firms here in LA. And I really wanted to do litigation. And I thought, wow, I feel like I want to be trained in a law firm first. I want to do litigation. And it looks like there's not really international litigation happening because international arbitration was not as active back then. So I ended up doing litigation, just plain old general commercial litigation, my first 7 years of practice. And then I got to a firm that did a lot of work in 1998. One of the former associates of the firm had gone on to become head of litigation at Yahoo. And then they did a lot for, you know, software companies like PeopleSoft and so forth. And that was my introduction to privacy, digital advertising, digital transformation, the importance of the internet. And that was, you know, Web 1.0. So I stayed at that firm from 1998 to 2007. And the rest is just, you know, a continuation and a further deepening of that. And along the way, it became very international by 2007, really working closely with the EU and the EU Privacy Directive, and then working at the APAC region and LATAM. So I got to do international law. I really moved from litigation to really more counseling for companies and then regulatory defense. So it all came together, but it's really interesting how a career can evolve.
That is fascinating. I think that I agree with you. A lot of times people look back and it looks like a very straight line and very orderly, but it was helpful to just hear you talk about how you ended up moving from area to area, but still ended up getting to do all the things that you were focused on.
At the end, yeah.
Yeah, no, so that's great. And I know that you and I have had a number of conversations about artificial intelligence and what that all means for data privacy. And you just have your book that has come out and I have my hands on it. It's called Trust, Responsible AI, Innovation, Privacy, and Data Leadership. Super excited for you about this book. And I want to delve into it a little bit more. One of the episodes that I did at the end of last year was just giving people like a level playing field for just like, what is AI? What is it not? So on and so forth. So I want to like delve into that area a little bit more with you, especially since you're such an expert in this field. And I want to start by just talking a little bit about a specific chapter that you have in your book. You have a chapter that discusses why data leadership is important now. So can you summarize a little bit for the listeners? Why is it important now?
It's important more than ever before, because data is the most important asset that any company has. It can either lead to the rise of the company, its products and services, or tank the company as far as its reputation and brand. So this is a core strategic asset that every company needs to pay attention to. And just the same way, the CEO and the board look at every other asset of the company, this area, data, and it's delivered now digitally for the most part, should be front and center of focus.
No, I agree. And in the work that I do, a lot of times I'm working with people in financial crime compliance and I'm doing risk assessments. And whenever somebody asks me what's the most challenging part, I always say it's making sure you have good data, right? Because a lot of times you realize that people who have access to information that maybe they should not have access to. So being very clear about who should have access, at what levels, how often do you look at the data, how do you scrub it, especially if you have PII, right? Being very clear about who has access to that information. So can you talk a little bit about some of the frameworks? I know, you know, you really focus on like some key frameworks that organizations should be focused on. So can you walk us through your thought process for that?
So I'm going to go straight to AI right now, because I just think that in very short order, AI is going to transform the way that we deliver digital services and the way that we access, you know, we had Web 1.0, 2.0, and right now we are in a major shift where everything will be massively transformed by AI. So this is exciting. The other thing is, just as a point, last year, we came close to licensing large language models and other types of AI, close to $1 trillion, okay? So that's around the globe. So companies around the world are going to be leveraging these licenses and building their own application on top of large language models and trying to leverage and developing efficiencies, new products. I just noticed Cedars-Sinai here in Los Angeles is using generative AI to be able to have early identification of pancreatic cancer. I mean, today, pancreatic cancer usually doesn't get identified until someone only has 3 or 4 months to live, Justice Ginsburg, et cetera. The idea that this technology is available to identify predilection for pancreatic cancer before anything develops at the genomic string level is pretty incredible. So we've got to use this technology, not just life and death, but financial, health, education, customized learning. Just imagine how elevating our student community, if education can be delivered in the way that every student can best understand it, how we will raise up, how education will raise up around the world, the living standards for so many. And this is what AI is capable of, and this is what's exciting. But it does come with risks. And the headlines we've been seeing sometimes make those risks seem insurmountable. But as a point in fact, governance is the key, the golden keys to get us out of the negative headlines and towards the amazing outcomes that AI should be known for. So let me pause here.
And governance is such a critical component to just how we think about really using AI in a positive way, right? And I think that one of the things that I get involved in quite a bit, especially in a lot of engagements, is thinking about what does that governance look like? What is your framework? How do you roll it out? How do you test it? How do you validate? So let's talk a little bit about what are the things that people, especially at the board level, and then at the compliance level, should be thinking about as they look at AI?
I'll start with this and then walk into governance. The main thing that every CEO and board member needs to understand is that our large language models, the state of the technology, as much as they're capable of in terms of early identification of cancer and life and death outcomes, the reality is the state of the technology is it's still very new in terms of being commercialized. It existed in the testing environments for 7 years, but being out into the commercial world is a new thing. That started with the splash of ChatGPT-4, I think, earlier last year. So the reality is this is emerging technology. And the key that every CEO and board member needs to understand is that the state of the technology is today that models do drift. So even when you have accurate and excellent governance in terms of training the data, so accurate data coming in that you have rights to, and IP rights, privacy rights to, business rights to, and you have accurate data coming out in terms of output on day one, over time, the model accuracy degrades and it will drift. So what are companies to do about that? Right now, what we've been seeing is a lot of headlines identifying that the model drifted. From drift comes hallucinations and inaccurate answers or misidentification of people or bias, et cetera, right? And all we're seeing are the headlines. The fix to this in order to use the technology is to insert into the AI tool itself guardrails on the areas that are most likely to harm the brand. Bias, IP, cyber, accuracy, health and safety, AI being used for drug development, for example, or a manufacturing use case. And then if the company's big enough, competition. And so those guardrails will sit in the system, much like a sensor on a window at your home as an alarm. The company, it's running. It's always there. The sensor is always there. You don't have to sit at home waiting for a burglar to come. You can go to work and do other things every day, but you will be alerted when the window is open and you're at work and no one's supposed to be there. So you know to either get home, look at your app, see what's happening. If a criminal's there, call the police. If not, get home and close the window. The same is true for AI and companies. The guardrails, the parameters of risk tolerance need to be put in numerically in code into the AI tool itself, so that not if, but when the model drifts outside of the company's risk tolerance, a human looks at the technical documentation of the continuous testing happening in the background, the metadata, the logging data, and identifies when exactly did this model start to drift, see if there's any changes in the training data that occurred that can be adjusted for, or there are other things that even when there are no changes in the business environment, there can still be drift, and we'll talk about that later, but diagnose the problem and fix the model, get it back into spec. And we don't really need to see, Tilsia, all these headlines that we're seeing. The misstep is that companies are not appreciating that models do drift.
I think you raise an excellent point, right? Because you're saying it's not if, but when. And so the importance of putting the guardrails from the very beginning, at the very start, when you're implementing AI and thinking about it thoroughly. And not just that, I mean, look, I mean, I think I work mostly with companies that operate in a regulated environment. And recognizing that at some point, the regulators are going to want to understand, what did you put in place? How are you testing it? How are you making adjustments when you need to? How do you explain certain results and behavior, right? Because explainability is also one of the big things. Talk a little bit about that and what you're seeing from your clients and how you're guiding them to address those issues.
Yeah, so explainability is such a great point, and I'm so glad you raised it, Tilsia. So I explain explainability. It's like such a great word. In the context of the governance journey, so there are six things that governments in 96 countries, six continents have put forward in either regulatory AI frameworks or draft legislation sitting before legislatures right now. So Europe has reached their political agreement. We're waiting for the final text as we're here talking. But looking at what all three prior versions agreed upon, looking at the White House AI executive order, looking at the White House AI Bill of Rights that is cited in the executive order that has a 70-page technical companion to explain governance, looking at, again, 96 countries and six continents, this is what they are calling for. So a risk ranking of the AI. There are about 13 use cases specifically that are considered prohibited, that governments around the world say they don't want private companies doing them. An example of prohibited AI is something like social scoring, looking at what a consumer does on LinkedIn or Meta or social media and making a decision about whether to underwrite a mortgage, for example.
That reminds me of that Black Mirror episode. I do remember that one.
Exactly. And I actually watched that episode. My executive assistant, Shabana, told me, you've got to see this. And I hadn't. And when I saw it, that's exactly it. Well, so that episode is exactly the reason governments around the world say it's too risky for private companies to engage in that. Another area, continuous monitoring of people, biometric monitoring in public spaces. They don't want private companies doing that on their own. If private companies are doing so as a vendor to law enforcement around the world, they want to make sure that law enforcement has judicial approval for that. And there are 13 other specific examples. Every board member, every CEO, every chief information officer or chief technology officer will want to know what those 13 use cases are that are prohibited, because it costs a lot of money to train a model, sometimes seven figures, sometimes eight figures for the bigger companies. And you want to make sure you're not training an application that's going to be considered prohibited in a couple of years in 96 countries. That's thing number one. On the low risk AI end, where you can kind of put your pedal to the metal, just imagine like an intersection and a green light, you have a green light on low risk AI. And those are things like chatbots that are not to sensitive areas like healthcare or financial, but just chatbots. You know, you're going to buy some jeans on a website. The idea is, most individuals have already been interacting with AI-powered chatbots, think Siri or your map app where it tells you to turn right or left. Those may have been powered by predictive AI, but the idea is if they're powered by generative AI, the incremental risk to humans is negligible. So you've got a green light on those sorts of low-risk use cases. The meat of the matter and the governance sits in high-risk AI, I don't know if you've seen this in your practice too. I'm sure you have, Tilsi, especially with financial services, but there are 138 examples from these frameworks of high risk. Every company ought to know what those 138 are, right? And I talk about it in the book. Some of them, I think about 75 of them, but you know, I keep an ongoing list because this is going to be constantly evolving as more companies come forward. And so anybody can always reach out to me to find out what the latest number is. We're up to 138, but companies need to know this is an ongoing evolving thing. So A, if you're in high risk, know what are high risk use cases, things like critical infrastructure, financial, children, health, employment use cases, behavioral advertising, believe it or not, behavioral data, profiling, you know, the power grid, other kinds of critical infrastructure, et cetera. If you are involved in high-risk AI, they're asking, in addition to the high-quality data that we talked about, the data being relevant material that you're training the model on, governance frameworks are calling for continuous testing, monitoring, and auditing to be happening in the background, not a once a week, once a month, once every quarter type of testing, because of the significance impact that high risk AI can have on humans. So they want the continuous testing. So you can, just like you're a sensor at home, you can be alerted as soon as the AI gets out of parameters so you can get it back on specs. You can understand why that's important. AI being used for an architectural use case, designs, and want to make sure that the specs are correct so that the building can safely hold people. Same thing with a healthcare use case, financial, et cetera, all the ones we've talked about. So explainability of the model, it comes after the continuous testing and monitoring, because pre-deployment, when you've continuously tested and monitored to see before we put it out in the wild, you're going to know what the AI is good at. This is what the AI is good at predicting, and this is what the AI shouldn't be used for. So transparency there, so that the end user knows this is what, whether it's a B2B user or a B2C user, this is what you should be using the AI for. Look at a nutrition label. And then once you have done the testing, monitoring, and auditing over time, the explainability comes in. Because you can say, well, this is where our model weights are, and this is how we keep it calibrated, and these are where our guardrails are. But you can't really do that in abstract or loosey-goosey. So continuous testing, monitoring, and auditing is key to be able to find explainability and transparency notices that derive from the tests. The technical documentation is the fourth step. That's making sure your testing, monitoring, and auditing is captured every second, every minute, every hour of every day in your logging data and metadata. And the reason that's in place is because the data scientist, the large language model expert, said, if we have to fix an AI on the power grid quickly and get services back up to people, we can't do that without a baseline, without logging data and metadata to see exactly when the model started to drift. So that's why these frameworks incorporate the technical documentation. Very important to be able to correct a model quickly.
And then it's not just the documentation part of it. It's also making sure that you have the right alarms and bells and whistles that will then trigger somebody to actually take a look at it and review it. Because a lot of times people are capturing the data, but they may not realize when it does drift, making sure that somebody's paying attention to that information that lets you know that you need to kind of like do something at this point in time, right? Because, you know, you also have a situation where there's a lot of data out there, but being very clear about what is it that you need to pay attention to and at what point are you going to have some kind of human intervention?
Exactly. So let's make this concrete. So say you have an HR use case and you want to make sure that you have a mix of 33% women, 33% men, 33% gender nonconforming. So say that for, you know, EEOC purposes or other equal opportunity purposes. So whoever is the HR officer or deals with this mix in regular employment context outside of your generative AI needs to be tapped to find out what are our guardrails as a company? When do we let it become 40%? That person, that individual on the bias test, right, will know what the threshold is the company's already using. And so in order to know how to alert the AI governance team, the guardrail with the person with the knowledge needs to be translated into numerical formula as a guardrail, zero zeros and seven sevens. So we want to be in 33%, but we'll be willing to go down to 25%, and on the high end, 45%. And that's what we do with our regular HR. Just make sure the AI knows that. And once those guardrails are in place, it's when the AI drifts outside of them, either lower than 25% or higher than 45%, that's when the AI team needs to react. But within the guardrails, right, just like the sensor on the window, there's nothing to do. Just go on about your business. You can check every once in a while, spot check, but it's not a necessity. But right, inputting the guardrails is the necessity, because that's going to tell you what to look at. Otherwise, you're completely in the dark. And that actually brings me to another issue, which is the AI governance team and the composition. Because as I said, regulators around the world have identified seven areas that can cause real harm, either emotional or physical harm to people. And that's where they want these guardrails inserted in the AI tool. Bias, IP, privacy, accuracy, health and safety, cyber, and if the company's big enough, antitrust. So those are seven different areas. And if the AI team doesn't have subject matter experts in those seven areas, the AI team certainly needs to know who the subject matter experts are in the company that deal with IP on a regular basis, that deal with antitrust on a regular basis, that deal with accuracy in the model, in other types of models and IT, people who deal with DE&I or HR or whatever bias, fairness calculations in the company, need to be on tap and available so that when you are working on an AI use case as a company, that you know to reach out to these subject matter experts who can say, this is what bias looks in this context. This is what accuracy looks like for a drug development use case. Accuracy is going to look different for a drug development use case than for an employment use case. And pancreatic cancer drug use case, accuracy is going to look different than a liver treatment. So what it is more of a reflex for governance to go reach out and get the guardrail parameters from the subject matter experts in order to place into the model itself.
This is excellent, excellent points, excellent advice. And I think that you and I both agree that AI is here to stay. It's been around, you know, since at least the 1950s, but it's just so pronounced now, and we see it everywhere, and it's here to stay. It's not going to go anywhere. I'm curious about, what are your thoughts for the outlook, right? As you think about how things are going to move forward, what are you thinking about and what are you concerned about?
I'm excited, Tilsia, for this podcast and for the work that we're all going to be doing this year. And I talk about this in the book. Humans control AI, not the other way around. We're at the inception of the commercial deployment of these tools. A lot of companies licensed them last year, and they're now beginning to come out with their pilots, their applications, and actually implementing. If we can get the message out here clearly that humans control the outcome, we have the ability to transform how billions of people will be impacted by this technology. And it's a very straightforward recognition that models drift, and we need to use this technology because of all the great it can do, but we've got to put guardrails in place so the models don't drift and hurt people. And it's a very straightforward message. And I'm excited that we're going to be deploying that message. And this podcast is part of that and a very important part. And I know all you're doing at FTI and with your clients, and many of us, I mean, we share clients and you work with us on a lot of efforts, but we all need to work individually and collectively on this key point, that AI is amazing, but it does require our attention. And if we put the right guardrails in place, we can minimize the downside and maximize the opportunity. And that's where we've got to get to as a global society.
Well said. Dominique, here at Finance and Leadership, we also like to know a little bit more about our guests. And so I'm going to shift topics and just ask you a little bit about, because I know you from other settings, I also know how much you focus on mentorship and how it's important to you. And I remember meeting one of your mentees and you bringing her over and saying, Tilsi, I want to make sure you meet her. And I know you go to New York all the time. I want to make sure the two of you connect. Tell me, why is mentorship so important to you?
Mentorship is critical. And when I look at anybody at any stage of career, whether they're new in their career, mid-career, or senior in their career, and they're making a pivot or aspirationally want to get from point A to point B, the future is all about their success. The future is all of us working together to uplift our aspirational folks. We all started someplace in career where we didn't know the ropes yet. And so what I try to tell everybody that I work with, I love talking to mentees. I do a quarterly mentee meeting. I started a mentee program with the International Association of Privacy Professionals because I had, I don't know, about 33 people had reached out to me on LinkedIn. So I was holding calls and then during Zoom calls. And then during George Floyd, the IAPP was talking about what they could do. And I thought, wow, you know, I'm doing these quarterly Zoom calls with the mentees that have had the, temerity to reach out to me cold on LinkedIn. But wow, what if we put the imprimatur of the organization? And my understanding now is they're doing them twice a month. There's over 200 people on it, but I need to get you on to be a mentor because you'd be amazing. But we had a plethora of amazing, accomplished mentors coming out of the woodwork to mentor this highly diverse group that just wanted to break into privacy. So I just started my next work nonprofit to diversify the C-suite and boardroom. We just placed two board members last year. I'm excited about that in private companies. But again, those are people senior in career.
Right.
But it's a go from where they are as outside of, on the management teams to actually transform themselves to be on a board. And I want to support all of those things. Because the future is all of us working together.
Now, I believe that leaders are readers. And sometimes, as we know, leaders also write books. But what I'm curious about is, are there any specific books, Dominique, that you recommend often or that you buy for other people? Just curious about, what's on your reading list?
Oh my gosh. Well, I have some favorites. So Hemingway, The Sun Also Rises, one of my favorite novels. I really enjoy that book and pick it up and reread it all the time. Yuval Noah, I really liked his book, Sapiens.
Yes, I've read that one.
It's a great book. Someone suggested this book to me and I thought it was really great, written by a tech company CEO, which is called The Untethered Soul. It's a really great book. And there's, Untethered Soul at Work and then there's The Untethered Soul. Very interesting perspective. And there's some visual artists like Richard Serra, who's one of my favorite artists. I have a couple of his works at home. He was on PBS, I think, on one show. And I remember him saying, work within your work. And other places you can see, work begets work or work within your work. But his idea is that once you delve into anything, in his world, it's visual art. But for me, it's the application is just what I do. You'll see other threads that come together that are become the next project. It's very much what I tell folks that I'm talking to about career or mentoring. It's one of the reasons the book came around and, this is my fourth book. But again, it's the working within the work that helps you identify additional work that needs to get done. Anyway, those are my favorite.
Excellent. And something else that I'm always curious about, for my guests is what is it that you're passionate about right now? And it doesn't have to be work-related. It could be outside of work, but just curious about, what are you passionate about?
I'm so passionate about getting the word out about the solutions for AI. And I think last year was a lot about headlines and the sky's falling and all of the dangers. And I'm just really glad to move on to 2024, where we get down to brass tacks and actually building governance, making AI amazing for our whole global society. We don't have to accept as a fait accompli that bias and IP violations and privacy and cyber mishaps or inaccuracies and misidentifications need to occur as a matter of course. They actually don't. And so I'm very passionate and excited about the message in the book of trust. that on a personal front, what I'm really also so passionate about is my family. I have a wonderful husband, Adam, and very fortunate to have an amazing mother, sister. When my dad was here, unfortunately, he passed in 99, but when he was here, you know, he and my mother were together for 33 years till he passed, but he was a 100% supporter, and that's how they are for me now. So I'm passionate about family and bringing what I feel I was very fortunate, and I am very fortunate to have around me, to try to push that out to as many people that may not have that. So if I can, you know, through the mentoring programs or others, be a reassurance that they are enough and they are amazing, that's what I want to do.
Well, Dominique, we're coming almost near the end of this podcast episode. I'm curious if there's anything else that you want to share or mention to our listeners.
The only thing I want to say and just reinforce again for everyone is that don't forget, whenever you see a headline about something that might have gone awry with AI, think testing, monitoring, and auditing. And would that have been caught if these guardrails were in place? And then become a passionate advocate for wherever you are in your company career. See something, say something. Be the change. Make sure that you get the word out that we can tackle this. We don't have to be besmirched in our reputation. So I'm excited for that message to be clearly relayed to your listeners.
No, I love that. And I think that your book is also provides so much rich information. So I'll make sure that that'll be mentioned as part of the bio that we will put out along with this episode. Thank you, Dominique, for coming on the show. I always enjoy our conversations. And I think the work that you're doing is so fantastic. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Tilsia. I really admire your work and all the governance work that you're doing and leading at FTI for cyber, data, privacy, AI.
Thank you.
If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please email financeandleadership@fticonsulting.com.